Good morning on this 12th of Never. My name is Michael McCusker. You are probably aware that yesterday was Armistice Day, 97 years since the First World War ended at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918. Americans call it Veterans Day, and you might feel oversaturated with patriotic war fever flowing like hot lava from all electronic orifices yesterday, especially all those Veterans Day sales, which act as a preview of the holiday shopping frenzies soon to erupt. Armistice means a cessation of war, not an end, just a break. But even that is anathema to the perpetual war hawks. Thus the change to Veterans Day, to venerate war and promote a never-ending supply of boots underground, solemnly referred to as our heroes. You might not know, however, that Tuesday, November 10th, was the 240th birthday of Mother Green's killing machine, otherwise known as the USMC, which is the subject of today's program. And since I wrote what I'm about to read, I am obliged to claim a disclaimer that what you are about to hear, unless you change stations or hit the off button, is my opinion and perhaps the opinion of no other Marine, alive or dead, in all the cosmos or multiple universes. I call it Semper Fallacious. And with a quote, I begin. And when he gets to heaven, to St. Peter he will tell, "One more Marine reporting, sir. I've served my time in hell." USMC, Guadalcanal. You know who he is by his anonymity. He has stared at you from magazine ads, TV and internet commercials, billboards, and countless Hollywood movies. Usually a grim and virile young male, he might be attired in a uniform of stiff dress blues with a round-billed hat, white as purity. Or he might be clothed in knife-sharp, starched green or camouflaged fatigues, his skull encased in a clean steel, camouflage-patterned bowl. He is, of course, always standing tall and proud. You generally do not see him without his legs or arms. You do not usually see his headless body, a smoking bloody hunk of raw meat draped with the confetti of his intestines. You do not see the pain, the anguish, the fear of despair indelibly scrawled across his wide-eyed, horrified face. He is a U.S. Marine, and he is 19 years old. And this year, he is also 240 years old. His uniforms and his weapons have changed in the nearly 2.5 centuries since the first Marines were recruited as rebels and traitors in a Philadelphia tavern in 1775. But he hasn't. He is the thrusted spear of America's wars, and like a spear, once thrown, he is often not retrieved. The Marine Corps birthday is November 10th, the day before Veterans Day, once known as Armistice Day. And of course, it is wildly celebrated. Messages lauding the great glory of the Corps flash across the country. Parties and ceremonies are held on almost every USMC base in the world and nearly every city in the nation. Perhaps the Marine Corps' most poignant and bittersweet birthday was its bicentennial in 1975. That was the year North Vietnamese soldiers marched into Saigon and put an end to the interminable Vietnam War. The self-ordained invincible Marines had lost their first war. 10 years earlier, in the spring of 1965, Marines landed at Da Nang, the first sizable American force in the rapidly escalating war, and spent most of the next decade up around the demilitarized zone that separated the two Vietnams. They fought hard, bloody battles against Viet Cong guerrillas and North Vietnamese army regiments. Their final appearance in Vietnam was guarding the U.S. Saigon embassy, while Americans and their Vietnamese counterparts fled in helicopters from the victorious soldiers of Hanoi. First in, last out. Defeat was not in the lexicon of several Marines and former Marines gathered at the Hilton Hotel in Portland, Oregon, for the bicentennial ball, yet it was palpable in its unspoken presence. For a few brief moments before they went below to the ballroom, the uniformed Marines gave the hotel lobby a resemblance to an American embassy. Most were in dress blues, their chests resplendent with colorful medals and ribbons from a dozen wars and decades of peacetime service. There was enough tin on their chests to build one of their beloved amphibious landing craft, but as impressive as they were, the rainbows of honors bestowed by their peers and several civil regnants did not erase the grim fact that they and their corps were celebrating their 200th anniversary with the first defeat in their history. But the Marine Corps was not defeated. Ask a Marine. It was the policy, not the Corps. The Marines had fought as hard as they ever had. They took the most casualties and percentage-wise received the most medals. These kids are better than we were, an old first sergeant said in Vietnam back in 1966, before the spearhead blunted, 23 years after he had waded through bullets and bodies of dead Marines in the lagoon at Tarawa. Semper Fidelis, the old faithful, clung to their gung-ho. They drank whiskey and talked about wars. They stood to attention when the colors passed them in review, carried smartly by young reservists dressed in Revolutionary-era uniforms. The Marine Corps hymn blared from a loudspeaker. Glory and sacrifice were the themes of the evening. Old Asia hands, most of them, from Chin Chin to Wei Fubai, they represented America's expanding and contracting dreams of Pacific Empire, the final, most expendable extensions of American foreign policy. Some of them had fought the Japanese. Some had survived the stalemate against North Koreans and Chinese. A few had been in Vietnam, anachronisms of limited war, a term seldom used before atomic bombs fell on Japan 70 years ago. A brigadier general was guest of honor, and when he got up to speak, he virtually ignored the war just lost. He instead eulogized old glories of USMC history and praised the Corps for restoring faith in our flag and country. Something else about Vietnam was also missing at the Hilton Bicentennial Birthday Ball: the young Marines who survived it. Older career men who had passed through the war at one time or another were in abundance, as were a significant number of officers. But the young grunt, the enlisted rifleman, who bore most of its burdens and sorrows, who fought its battles, he wasn't present or accounted for. A scattering of new enlistees were in attendance, closing ranks around a generation of Marines and a war that seemed as absent as though none of it had ever happened. There are no ex-Marines here, the guest general cadenced the old cliches. There is no such thing as an ex-Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. And the president, who was Gerald Ford that year, himself a World War II Navy officer, sent a message to all Marine stations and read aloud at the Hilton, praised the USMC as a fighting force that has commanded history's respect and America's pride. Pride's corpse was resplendent at the Hilton that night, quite evident among the celebrants as a mauled feeling shared by those who had been to Vietnam and those who hadn't, of honorable men used badly in a dishonorable cause, and the weary attempt to reinstill some esprit de corps into the vanquished ethos came out hollow. From a small Pennsylvania tavern, Tun Tavern, Aka Peg Mulligan's Beef Steakhouse, to the Hilton Hotel in 200 years. From revolutionary patriots to corporate Tories, the history of the Marine Corps was a mirror of America's diverging and contradictory view of itself. Created as a skeleton force of dissidents to help combat the largest empire in the world, the Corps, like the nation, born of revolution, had become the world's fiercest counter-revolutionary force. Never known for its modesty, the USMC proclaimed itself the greatest killing machine on earth. This process begins with 3 months basic training, the Marine Corps' famously infamous boot camp. The ripping away of the psyche and its identity is calculatingly and efficiently brutal. And though Marine drill instructors are no longer allowed to physically harm their hapless recruits, the scandal surrounding the deaths of 7 recruits in a Paris Island swamp in 1956 brought this about. Covertly, they still do, with gloves or administered where knuckle marks don't show. The process of tearing and rebuilding works remarkably well, to such an extent that a pummeled recruit stoically and even proudly accepts and endures whatever punishment is handed him. The regimen is so strict and harsh that these former individuals desperately strive and exhaust their strengths for the privilege of being anonymous cogs in a green machine. The flaws in Marine Corps masculinity stem not from the values constituting the myth, but from the ones that are discarded. William Hart, an ex-Marine turned news reporter, wrote in an article, Manly to the Core. In order to gain membership in the Brotherhood, the recruit must banish the impulse to question his totalitarian regimen. To achieve the identity of a Marine, he must disown his individuality. He obtains manhood at the price of freedom. And that was William Hart. Many lose more than their freedom. A large number of young men, and probably young women, whose training is somewhat less rigorous because they do not go en masse into combat yet, are psychologically damaged, often permanently. The credo is to break them in training instead of cracking in combat. For what they do, given the horrific conditions of warfare that American life does little to prepare them for, there is a savage logic to that purpose. No responsibility, however, is extended toward those who are unable to resist the attempt to break them. The victims are left to blame themselves for their subsequently ruined lives, and the fact they were washed out is generally held against them personally. The convoluted logic that surrounds war making and the fitness of those who make war is seldom questioned. The harsh process of Marine Corps training is accepted as a necessary ritual to ensure survival for those who make it through, giving them a chance to endure and perhaps live a little longer amidst horror. History does respect, often too lavishly, such elite military organizations as the Marines make themselves out to be. A serious review of Marine Corps history would produce any number of murderous frenzies whose only recommendation might be the general courage of the Marines caught in an irreversible nightmare. It is this courage and the barrels of blood spilled that fires the spirits of most militarists and presumes a savagely doomed view of humanity. However, the average Marine is not a follower of Bushido, and the adolescent stirrings of lean and mean martial glory soon wear off for most, if not in training, or through the cynical compromises made for survival within the military system, certainly in the blood and terror of combat. A Marine is a skeptical and often horrified footnote to a mutant history that perpetuates more of him and, more than ever, her, to fill the rank and file. Anthony Edgeworth quoted a Marine in an Esquire magazine article, "I swear to God they make you feel you're not really a Marine until you've been killed in action." Ex-Marine Hart wrote that, in its extreme, the image of the Marine Corps reflects, if crudely, an awareness that the central issue of a man's life is his death. As for America's pride, self-delusion is the leitmotif of the Marine Corps. And that pride, too, is a delusion, more complicated because, in the final analysis, underneath the myth and the machismo, who truthfully feels proud to be a murderous pawn? Anton Meyer, a Marine veteran of World War II, wrote that he knew at last, beyond a shadow of a doubt, all it was to be as an infantryman, defenseless, pitiable, and alone, armed with nothing but one's own flesh and blood. The U.S. Marine met his match with the North Vietnamese soldier and the irregular Viet Cong guerrilla. military strategists preparing for newer wars in their peculiar manner of envisioning the future through the past will probably decide that the North Vietnamese produced a superior soldier than did the USMC. That fact is undoubtedly a reason that of all the American armed forces loosened up in face of public demand, the Marine Corps rigidifies its discipline and training. It might also be a reason the guest Marine Brigadier General at the Portland Hilton Bicentennial Birthday Ball paid sparse attention to the 10 years Marines fought in Vietnam. Instead, he catapulted over the entire war in a speech eulogizing the glories of Marine Corps history and praised Marines who stormed ashore a tiny Cambodian island that same spring the U.S. abandoned Vietnam to rescue crewmen of the captured American cargo ship Mayaguez, who were not in need of rescue and who were not on the island for, as he said, restoring faith in our flag and country. More than 100 Marines were killed or wounded to restore that faith, which was, after all, an illusion and a microcosm of the whole war in its errant calculations and waste of lives. Nothing was restored, nothing was gained except in the beleaguered circles of power attempting to assuage a great and resounding defeat with the swatting of a mosquito. Probably no one will ever know, nor will most Americans much care, how many Cambodians were killed or injured in the island assault, as few other than anti-war dissenters ever really gave a damn about the Vietnamese, publicly content to settle for the distortions of Vietnamese identity provided by the Pentagon, almost to the very last. Among Marine commanders, the Mayaguez raid revealed a chaotic historical self-deception. They were resurrecting the primal Marine Corps legend by assaulting the shores of Tripoli again. The quintessential myth and most popular view of the Marine Corps is the bloody head-on assaults upon Pacific islands in World War II. Its most familiar icon, the raising of the Stars and Stripes on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. But there is another side to the USMC, more ominous and clandestine than the legends. Its core purpose, a retaliatory anti-guerrilla warfare and counterinsurgency. U.S. Marines act primarily as America's overseas police force, protecting and enlarging its political and commercial interests since the late 19th century, with notable incursions into Japan, China, Formosa, which is now Taiwan, Korea, and Vietnam. In just 3 years, between 1897 and 1900, Marines intervened in Haiti at least 8 times, and as many as a dozen times in Nicaragua. And they helped squelch Filipino independence after the Spanish-American War of 1898. A special case is Haiti, where the USMC attempted to impose corporate democracy in 1915, though it is difficult to see how democracy can be forced upon a society and be truly democratic. The Marines imposed martial law and controlled Haitian towns, schools, and political offices while harshly suppressing opposition parties and the press, taking over the economy and instituting a corvée system of slave labor to build roads without pay. The USMC also established a military caste that subsequently ruled Haiti after the Marines left in 1934. Democracy was not the real purpose of the USMC's occupation of Haiti, but instead to tether Haiti to American political and business interests. The Marines were as prepared to teach democracy to Haitians as they were to Filipinos a decade earlier and Vietnamese more than half a century later. Winning hearts and minds is not a primary mission of such a closed, authoritarian, and hard-nosed military corps as the USMC. In 1929, after postponing popular elections, Marine machine gunners opened fire on a large crowd of demonstrating Haitians. Earlier, in 1918, the year World War I ended, anger at forced labor broke out in rebellion against the USMC-controlled government in Haiti. The Marines managed to kill the rebel leader, but martyred him as a result, as also occurred in Nicaragua. Most Haitians hated the occupation, which finally ended when the Marines gradually withdrew in 1934 after nearly 20 years on the island of Hispaniola, which Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic, also a focus of periodic American attention. The USMC made landings there in 1965 to combat communist insurgents, quote unquote. The Marines had a three-tier approach to its policing activities in Latin America following World War I: civic action, construction of public works and highways, and establishing local constabularies. The public construction was resented as unpaid slave labor, as demonstrated in Haiti, and civic action, a superficial attempt to encourage democracy, was undermined by the Marine-supervised gendarmerie, from which dictators invariably emerged after the Marines departed: the Somoza regime in Nicaragua, Rafael Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, and the worst of all, Francois Papa Doc Duvalier and his infamously vicious Tonton Macoutes in Haiti. The Marine Corps attempted to use some of the practices evolved in Latin America during the Vietnam War three decades later, most notably the civic action concepts and combined action platoons of both Marines and South Vietnamese village militias, and by guarding golden fleece rice harvests from the Viet Cong. But like virtually everything else the U.S. did in Vietnam, especially its counterinsurgency doctrines, none of it worked. The USMC calls itself America's 9/11 force in this new century millennium, and in response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attack on the USA's financial and military citadels, it has formed an anti-terrorism brigade for homeland defense that prepares to go to war in American cities, quote unquote, to combat terrorism. The brigade allegedly consists of a security battalion as well as nuclear, biological, and chemical response units. At present, the Posse Comitatus law prohibits the U.S. military from being involved in domestic law enforcement. But the former Bush administration and members of Congress attempted to repeal it to meet what they claimed the new contingency of safeguarding the homeland against foreign and domestic terrorism. If repeal is eventually successful in the future, the result would most likely be the formation of elite Marine SWAT teams, a recurring nightmare of our forebears who wish to curb the insatiable domestic tyrannies of militarists and autocrats. So now we have the U.S. Marine, the Spartan ideal, the loyal samurai, celebrating his and her 240th birthday on November 10th, the day before the 33rd anniversary of the Vietnam Wall Memorial on Veterans Day, 1982. Finger on the trigger of yet another war or wars, waiting to attack or defend, hurled once more into the pitiless crucible of combat. Most of his wars have been sundered by the merciless glare of history to be not at all great crusades for civilization or God, but instead paltry and repressive struggles for eminent domain. Justification might be made for the Marine Corps' costly role in the two world wars if one overlooks the incredible blunders and blatant militarism that led to those wars, the time-softened names of death: Chateau Thierry, Belleau Wood, Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Saipan, Iwo Jima, Okinawa. The arguments about Korea, Incheon, the Frozen Chosen, are bitter and polarized, never at rest. But no other purpose than naked power was responsible for the Philippines campaign at the beginning of the 20th century. The same held true for the so-called Banana Wars in Central America and the Caribbean, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Honduras, during the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s, and for the invasions of Grenada and Panama in the 1980s. Since at least the Persian Gulf War of 1991, the Marine Corps' attention has shifted from Asia to the Middle East, although in 1983, more than 200 Marines were killed and nearly 130 wounded by a terrorist truck bomb in Beirut, Lebanon, in retaliation of a Marine incursion response to a suicide bombing of the U.S. Embassy. The Marines were unwisely barracked in a hotel, which the truck bomb blew apart. The USMC provides combat muscle to a military corporate coalition that formulates what is anticipated to be a series of oil wars for control of Middle East fields and pipelines, underscoring the public hype for perpetual war against terrorism and radical Islam, which includes ISIS, etc. The war against former Cold War ally Iraq, the continuing war in Afghanistan, the prevailing American right-wing crusade for war against Iran, are a preview of a part of the world the Corps might be bitterly acquainted with long into the future. Add the recent names of Fallujah and Haditha to the USMC roll call of horror. The pride of the Marines, and that's a quote from a long rallying cry, you might say, to sustain itself must be internalized, become one of profession instead of cause or ideals. The argument thus constructed is one of stoicism in the face of adversity, the bright jewel of courage for its own sake, never presuming to question how wasted the finest qualities of humanity are when put to the purposes of war. War is the purpose and shrine of the Marine Corps' existence. Send in the Marines is a cliche that hardly needs explanation. Semper Fi. And that was something I wrote, Semper Fallacious. I would like to now read a poem, Soldier Unrequited. He lay nestled in a blue plaid cotton nest. With his head covered by a faded D ball cap, it rested upon many years of stains embroidered across a once white but graying feather pillow. Placeless sleep written upon the gray, uncut, bearded face, shifting sideways, room fishing. His body twisted into a stenciled box, emblazoned, whirlpool for the way it's made. Shards of wind-driven memory dreams in circles about the brown paper bag adobe hut, strange birds chasing the unforgotten of distant wars, battles, deaths and lies, smoldering garbage flies. Promises left unturned, stones of abandonment, weighing souls into depths where bottled fuel only dampens and blurs, but never completely. If there be tears, it only mixes in the muddy day. Wishes, fine ash dust, long blown to seas of despair, never crossed the dividing line, sown with sweat, painted in the blood of collapsing lungs, swollen kidneys, the lost hero's final gesture of giving. We stand back, aside, behind in distaste, in shame, for our fear is small and love even smaller yet. What is owed can never be repaid, repaired, except unconditionally, and in the dream, they wait. And that was Soldier Unrequited, written by Gerald Rinks, who lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He is the father of Miranda Rinks, who is a persistent, sporadic resident of Astoria when she is not living in some other part of the world. Gerald Rinks is a Vietnam veteran. This poem was meant for a newspaper I had stopped publishing before I received it. At long last, I release it from its undeserved tomb. And I'd like to read a couple of other poems. The first, Road to Basra, by Richard Blakely. So much darkness has been pulled from the sky to make this day. Black plumes ascend like wounded wings in a last-ditch effort to hide the living. History treads on the blind miller's stone. How many will die today? How much slower humanitarian aid travels than smart bombs? The dragon of the West, drunk, backslides in the rhetoric of its own oil slick. The Dark Age, now on wheels, rolls along the road to Basra, burning 500,000 gallons of diesel per day. The legs of the camel tremble under the weight of our wants and how much we want. From the spotless decks of the USS Milius, computer-savvy professionals launch tomahawks, pacified, its crews seek consolement in the nightly rotations, popcorn and movie night, bingo night, Snapple and cigar night. The mess hall is dizzy, decked out in 50s nostalgia. Marley and Elvis shine on. And that was by Richard Blakely. He committed suicide by jumping off the Astoria Bridge in March 2007. And a poem by Margaret Bowler, After War. Here, over blood-stained, craggy, barren soil, the tattered banner waves high above the final battlegrounds where hundreds slaughtered lie in eternal sleep, their blood tinting the dirt. The banner flies, held up by the wind, witness to desolation until time itself tears the fabric remnants from the pole and everything crumbles to dust. And that was Margaret Leah Bowler. I think she was about 11 when she wrote that. And this has been Michael McCusker.